So we're all interested in meditation, of course. But it's very important before we meditate that we learn the teachings. Otherwise, we don't know how to meditate or what to meditate on. Okay? So meditation isn't just a process of closing our eyes and letting our mind wander. Okay? And then within meditation, there's different kinds of meditation. Some are stabilizing meditations to develop concentration. Others are analytic, or what we call checking meditations, and that's to develop insight and understanding into the Buddhist teachings. And eventually we want to combine those. Then there's also the meditation where we're trying to understand an object, such as impermanence or the ultimate nature. And then there's the meditation where we're trying to transform our mind into a certain outlook. For example, meditation to develop great compassion. Okay. So within the medicine Buddha sadhana, or the practice text that we have, there's many different kinds of meditation. And the idea is that our mind is very complicated, so we need different kinds of meditation and meditations on different objects to transform all the different parts of ourself. One kind of meditation alone won't do it because of the complexity of our mind. And because if we want to attain Buddhahood, then there's many different aspects of ourself to purify and to develop. Okay? So, let's just look at the text very briefly, yeah, so that you get a general idea of the psychological method that is contained within the text. And then we'll go back and go through the different stages of it in more depth. Okay? So we start out with visualizing the medicine Buddha in the space in front. Now, some people say, oh, Tibetan Buddhism, you visualize, it just creates more distraction. Yeah? We should empty our mind of everything. Well, emptying our mind is one type of meditation. Visualization has some very unique functions. First of all, it takes our usual habitual tendency to imagine, which we're doing all day anyway. And instead of imagining your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your children, the food you're going to have for lunch, you know, the jewelry you want, the sports equipment you want, what you're going to do in the evening. Instead of imagining all of that, we're imagining the medicine Buddha. So it's the natural, we're taking the natural tendency of our mind to imagine and flipping it and putting it in a good direction. Okay, because we're imagining all the time anyway. Now some people say, oh, I can't visualize. Yes, you can. Okay, even with your eyes open, if I tell you to imagine durian, do you have a visualization in your mind of what a durian looks like and smells like and tastes like? Yeah, you do, right away, don't you? Even your eyes are open. You know what color it is, you know the smell, how can you ever forget the smell of dirty? Okay, so that is imagination, that's visualization, right there. Yeah. If I tell you, think of your mom, you have a mental image of your mom in your head, in your mind right away, even if she's not here. Okay? So all of that is visualization. We have the ability to visualize. Also, by visualizing the medicine Buddha in the space in front, it makes us feel like we're in his presence. So just imagining that you're in the presence of a fully awakened one, really, it does something to our mind. Okay? It's like, you know, do you guys have Spider-Man here? Yeah, I figured you did. So Spider-Man's the latest thing in the States too. So you can imagine Spider-Man, and what kind of feeling does that give you in your mind? Do you become peaceful, tranquil, benevolent when you imagine Spider-Man? No. When you imagine the medicine Buddha sitting there, do you have a feeling of peace and compassion and so on? Yeah. Just by the way he looks, the way he's sitting, that comes through to us. So the visualization, you know, has a powerful impact on our mind. When you visualize, don't expect to see anything with your eyes, okay? This is done with the mental consciousness. So it's just a conceptual appearance, but it can be very strong. Okay, so we visualize the medicine Buddha in front of us, and we think that we're surrounded by all the other living beings, and then we lead the other living beings in taking refuge in the medicine Buddha. Okay, so by imagining all the other sentient beings around us, we're making sure that we don't see our meditation practice as a rejection of other sentient beings, the rejection of everything. And I'm going off to do my own blissful concentration and forget everybody else. Okay? No, we're thinking of everybody else, but we're thinking of them in a different way. Yeah? We're thinking of them as sentient beings who want happiness and don't want suffering, but who are confused and often create the causes of suffering and not the causes of happiness. And so we, you know, are looking to the medicine Buddha for teachings so that all of us can practice and settle our minds down. Okay, so we're including all the people, the ones we like, the ones we don't like, okay, because we're all basically in the same boat. Okay, then we do the prayer of taking refuge, generating bodhicitta, which is the aspiration for full awakening. So, taking refuge tells us what direction we're going in our practice. Yeah, we're doing a Buddhist practice. We're taking refuge in the three jewels. That's where the way we're directing our mind. Okay, so we aren't doing, you know, seances, and we aren't doing Sufi dancing, and we aren't doing church, you know, chanting, church singing, or whatever. Okay, we're doing Buddhist practice, so we have that clear in our minds. And then by generating bodhicitta, we have clear in our minds why we're doing this practice. So it's not just so that we feel good, it's because we really want to benefit all sentient beings. Okay. So those two things are very important to have very clear in our mind at the beginning of the practice. Who is our guide, and why are we doing this? From there, we move on to the four immeasurables. So those are four feelings, you know, or emotions that we generate towards all sentient beings. So we begin with a feeling of equanimity, yeah, which is free of bias, attachment, and anger. Then we proceed to generate love, which wishes others to have happiness in its causes. Then we generate compassion, wishing them to be free of suffering and its causes. And then we generate joy, wishing that they're never separated from the ultimate bliss. Okay? So that's reinforcing our attitudes towards sentient beings, reinforcing our bodhicitta motivation. And then we do the prayer of special bodhicitta, again, really reinforcing our motivation. Okay. From there, then we go into the actual practice. And so here we begin the practice with a seven-limb prayer. And so the seven-limb prayer is done to purify our mind and to accumulate merit. And I'll go through those seven as we go through the whole practice in a slower way. But the idea of purification and accumulation of merit is that before we can actually attain realizations, we need to prepare the mind. It's like before you plant a garden, you need to prepare the soil. If you don't prepare the soil, you may plant seeds, but they're not going to be able to grow. Okay, so to continue the garden analogy, we first purify the soil. We take out all the trash, okay, and all the rocks. So in our mind, what we do is we purify our negative karma. Okay, that's the kind of trash in our mind. Then, in the garden, you add fertilizer, yeah, to enrich the soil. And with our mind, we accumulate merit by doing certain practices to accumulate merit, and that enriches our mind. Then we can either listen to teachings or do the actual practice, and our mind is prepared. Okay? Sometimes we like to skip over preparations. And we want to get to the good stuff. But we think, oh, preparations, that's baby stuff. Actually, preparations, first of all, are very important. And they are baby stuff. They're actually not so easy. So they're really things to put our mind into. You've been seeing the video of we're going to build a Buddha hall at the Abbey. When we build the Buddha hall, we don't start with the roof. Okay? And we don't start with the walls either. Yeah. First, we have to level the ground. Yeah. And we have to put in the septic system and all these other kinds of things. And then we have to build the foundation. And the foundation's really exciting because you get these big concrete trucks rolling up the hill. And you hope they make it because our hill has S-curves like this. Yeah, it's hard for the drivers to drive it. And we have to pour, first the footings, then the entire foundation. So when we built Chenrezi Hall, Venerable Tarpa and I poured a little bit of it. It was really fun. You remember that? We, the guys who were pouring the concrete, they lent us their hardest hats. We had our old clothes on and we held the big hose-like things with the concrete spitting out of it really quickly. You know, and so we did a little bit, you know, so that we could be involved, and then we gave it back to them to finish. Okay. Because doing the concrete, you know, it's not easy, especially if you have to build a concrete wall in the back so that the back dirt doesn't slide down the hill. It's not easy. So don't think preparations are baby stuff. You know, they're actually quite important. If you don't have good preparation, if you don't build good footings and a good, you know, back wall against the earth in the back, and you don't build a good foundation, you may have, you know, great building material for walls and roof, but they're not going to be able to stand up for very long. They're going to crumble. Okay? So that's why we do the seven-line prayer, to purify and accumulate merit. Then we go on to the mandala offering, and here we offer the entire universe and everything in it, and we don't imagine. We imagine the universe in a very pure form. We don't offer the Buddha all the bombed-out buildings in Syria, okay? We imagine everything in a very beautiful form, and we offer that to the Buddha. So again, this is a practice that we do to create merit, making an offering. Okay? Then there's a request. There's three requests to the Medicine Buddha. Okay? And there's a corresponding visualization that goes with the following requests. Okay? So we have three requests, then a visualization, and then another request to all of the Medicine Buddhas. So there's a simple Medicine Buddha practice where you imagine the Medicine Buddha, that's all. This one here is one where we imagine all of the Medicine Buddhas. So there's seven Medicine Buddhas, and then we include Shakyamuni Buddha as well. Okay. So the first, so then we have to ask, why do we do requests? And people often are puzzled by requests because they say, Buddha is not a god. Why are we making requests of Buddha for this, that, and the other thing? You know, they confuse it with like praying to Brahma or God or some kind of divine being, you know, who's a creator, who manages the world and so on. And the Buddha is not like that, okay? So the process of making requests is we're not asking Buddha, we're not really asking Buddha to do something for us while we take a nap. Okay, you know, the first thing, you know, we may ask the Buddha, you know, to inspire our mind so we gain wisdom and compassion. And then we say, okay, I requested the Buddha to do it. It's all the Buddha's responsibility. I'll take a nap. And then I'll wake up and there will be wisdom and compassion in my mind. Oh, what a nice daydream. But it doesn't work that way, okay? In Buddhism, we're responsible for our lives. And if we want to advance, we have to put in the energy to do it. The request that we make to the holy beings is like making a statement to ourselves about what we want to generate and how we want to transform our own mind. So we put it in the form of a request because our habit as sentient beings is always to ask somebody else to do the work. Yeah? I'll take a break, you do the work. So this, you know, we request the Buddha for spirit, for real inspiration, for you know, realizations. But what we're really doing is reminding ourselves that we need to practice and create the causes to have these realizations and to have these qualities. so it's a psychological method of asking ourselves, okay, we're projecting it outwards, but we're really talking to ourselves. And that comes home with the visualization that follows. Because in the following visualization, we have Guru Medicine Buddha on top of our head. And then above him, all the other medicine Buddhas. Okay? When we do the requests to the medicine Buddhas, the one at top dissolves into the next one. When we do the second verse, that one dissolves into the third one. When we do the third verse, the third one dissolves into the fourth. So that at the end, we only have Guru Medicine Buddha on top of our head. Okay? And then, you know, so he's now embodying all the realizations, all the energy of all the other medicine Buddhas. And then, following that, do you have the sadhana? You don't. Oh, okay. I was thinking that you did, and you could follow along with what I'm doing, but you don't. Okay. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we have it. Okay. So here's where we are right now. Yeah. So when we go through the, we'll start from the top and go through it when we actually do the practice. Here we have the verses on the beginning. Okay. So we do those verses, and each medicine Buddha dissolves into the one below it. Okay. And then there's two possibilities. There's for people who have not received the jnana or the permission to do the medicine Buddha practice from a lama, then there's one visualization you do. If you have received the jnana, sometimes it's called an initiation, but, you know, it's actually a permission to do the practice, then those people do a different visualization. I think here, when we're doing the practice as a group, we'll stick with the first one, because that way everybody can join in and participate. Okay. So in this one, yeah, then we have Medicine Buddha on top of our head, all the other ones have dissolved in, and he's here. He's here. And then light streams down from the Medicine Buddha. First white light that we imagine enters into our whole body, and it purifies our negative karma and any kind of illness or disease or injury or whatever that we might have been experiencing. And then second, we imagine golden light flowing down into our body, and think that all the realizations of the Medicine Buddha are flowing into us. Okay. And while we're doing those visualizations, we chant the mantra. So you're visualizing and chanting the mantra at the same time. Although, you know, if it's hard multitasking like that, then it's fine if you, let's say, stop the mantra and just focus on the visualization, or stop the visualization and focus on the mantra, you know. But then sometimes try and bring them together so you're doing both at the same time. And then a third visualization you do is you remember that you're still seated with all the sentient beings around you. So you renew that visualization and imagine that there is a medicine Buddha on the crown of each of those sentient beings. And then you do the same process with the white light, then with the golden light, and imagine them being purified and sentient beings receiving all the realizations of the medicine Buddha. Okay? Then we go on. Okay, so we do the mantra. And then, usually we have medicine Buddha dissolving into us. Yes, that's there. Okay, it says recite the mantra while doing these visualizations. At the conclusion of the mantra recitation, the medicine Buddha melts into light and absorbs between your eyebrows, blessing your body, speech, and mind. Okay? So you've purified, received the inspiration and the realizations of the medicine Buddha, and then you think that the medicine Buddha dissolves into light, and then that light enters you through the spot in between your eyebrows and dissolves in your heart. And then you meditate on really feeling like, you know, the medicine Buddha is in your heart. And, you know, you're close to the medicine Buddha. And that helps you really gain confidence in practice. It helps you imagine being a Buddha yourself. Imagine having the qualities of the medicine Buddha. Imagine having the understanding the emptiness of the mind, just like the medicine Buddha does. So you focus on that. Yeah? And then afterwards, we dedicate the merit. So we share the merit. We not actually share it. We don't give it away. What we're doing is directing it so that it will ripen according to our motivation, which was to become fully awakened and for all living beings to become fully awakened. Okay? So, do you see the psychological process that's happening here? We start by imagining perfection outside of us. We relate to the medicine Buddha as that symbol of perfection. Okay? Purify our mind, create merit, think of the qualities of the medicine Buddha and those qualities absorbing into our own mind. And then the medicine Buddha himself absorbs into our own mind. And we meditate that we're non-dual, we're not separate from the medicine Buddha. Okay, so we started out projecting outside. In the end, it all dissolves back into our own mind. Okay? But we've been on this journey between the projection and the dissolution. And the journey is one of purifying our own mind and contemplating the causes to gain the medicine Buddha's realization. Okay. So it's a whole, it's a whole journey every time we do this sadhana. Okay, so any questions so far?
Hi, everyone. Just now you talk about the visualization. When we visualize the medicine Buddha and it becomes a rays of light and enters through our body, so where is the final destination, the ray of light going to reach? Is it on mine or?
I didn't understand the last part. What is the.
I mean, when you say about visualization about medicine Buddha, so when we are visualizing medicine Buddha, then becomes the eight medicine Buddha becomes a which becomes the ray of light and absorbs into our body. Mm-hmm. So when it absorbs into our body, so where is it going to reach?
Yeah, when we're doing that, when we're chanting the mantra, we're just imagining the light filling our entire body. Okay.
No.
Well, at the end, when the medicine Buddha dissolves into us. It comes in through here. And then he comes to rest at our heart center, which is in the center of our chest. Okay? So this is, it's a visualization, and the visualization is made of light. So don't get confused about, well, but you know, how's all this light going to get in? Because there's a brain here and a throat and I have my lungs and, you know, there's no space for the medicine Buddha to come into my body. This is a visualization, so you don't have that difficulty.
Actually, so I know that when we visualize the light, penetrates through our crown. From our crowns and
Yes, there's two ways to do it. One way is through the eyebrows, another way is through the crown, and it descends and rests at our heart. So there's two ways. Okay? Yeah. What's wrong with alternative ways? Yeah? So this sadhana says through the eyebrows, if you want to do it through the crown of your head, there's nothing wrong with that. Okay.
That's a good one.
Okay. So let's go back to the beginning and go and talk about the different steps a little bit more. Okay? So, can we have the beginning text? Okay. So, the visualization that we do, yeah, it's not written here, but you can see the medicine Buddha very clearly. Yeah. So, the Buddha, on the crown of our head, there is a lotus flower, an open lotus flower, you can see. On it is sitting the medicine Buddha. This entire visualization is made of light. So don't think of a painting or a statue. Yeah? And the medicine Buddha, is wearing the robes of a monastic. His right hand is in the gesture of giving refuge. So he's reaching out to sentient beings, to help sentient beings. The left hand is in the gesture of meditation. So it shows that as a fully enlightened one, he can reach out and be active in the world to benefit and simultaneously be in meditation. Now, in his left hand, he's holding an alms bowl. The alms bowl is filled with the medicinal substances. Chiefly, there's one called Arura that they use in India as the basis of a lot of Indian, the Ayurvedic medicine and Tibetan medicine as well. Okay? Now, when you look at the medicine Buddha, like I was saying at the beginning, you get a certain feeling, don't you? I mean, he's sitting there completely at ease, completely peaceful, completely grounded and centered. Yeah? So when you look at that picture, it affects the mind. Yeah? Just as I was saying, if you look at the picture of Spider-Man, that also is going to affect your mind. But we're not meditating on Spider-Man to become awakened. That's not going to work. Okay, so you can see, he's just totally grounded, present, balanced, aware of what's going on, and yet his mind is in deep meditation. Okay. So, we visualize medicine Buddha. If you want to, at this point, you can stop and just do some concentration meditation using the medicine Buddha as your object of concentration. Okay? So the Buddha taught many objects to develop concentration. Very often we start with the breath, but the breath doesn't work with everybody, and some people prefer a visualized image. Yeah? So this works quite well. The advantage of developing more concentration on the medicine Buddha is that then it becomes easier to remember the qualities of the Buddha during your life, and it becomes easier at the time you're dying to remember the medicine Buddha. And at the time we die, we definitely want to remember any Buddha we can, yeah? Because if we can do that and take refuge and generate bodhicitta at the time we die, then we're going to have a very good rebirth. Yeah? So this is also a way to really prepare our mind, you know, for the time of death. Okay, so medicine Buddhas on top of our head, right? And we're surrounded by all the sentient beings. So like I said before, we can't ignore any sentient being. Yeah. It's not that you just have your friends around you. You have all of them around you. Even the ones you don't like, the ones you fear, the ones who have hurt your feelings, and so on. Okay, they're all around you. And you care about all of them. And we're going to get into the four immeasurables, which will help us develop that thought that cares about all of them. Okay? So, but first, we take refuge and generate bodhicitta. Okay? So, I take refuge, and we're thinking everybody's reciting it with us until we're awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, okay? And the merit that we create by practicing generosity and the other perfections or far-reaching practices. Now, through doing that, may we become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. So when it says the six far-reaching practices, those are the six perfections that are practiced by a bodhisattva. So, first, generosity. Second, ethical conduct. Third, patience or fortitude. Fourth, joyous effort. Fifth, meditative stability. And sixth, wisdom. Okay. So those are six very important practices. Please memorize that list. Please know them. If you can't remember them, how are you going to practice them? Yeah? Yes, you. He's been studying for a while, or maybe not studying for a while. Okay, so we should remember these and then learn how to do those practices. Okay, then we go to the four immeasurables. Okay, so four immeasurables, equanimity, love, compassion, and joy. Yeah, sometimes you can come sit up here. I'm going to be on this verse for a long time. Sometimes we find them in a different order. First starting with love, then compassion, then joy and equanimity at the end. Okay. So there's two different orders because they emphasize two different ways of approaching these four. Okay. So the usual order that you may be familiar with, starting love, then compassion, joy, and equanimity. Okay, that's the way it's often presented in the Pali tradition, is we, okay, there's two ways to explain this. So one way, our usual way of regarding sentient beings is with loving kindness and with friendliness. So whenever we see other sentient beings, the way we want to approach them is just with friendliness and kindness. Okay? So that's already a big task, isn't it? But if we really make a firm decision to try and change our mind, then at least we can start breaking the habit of approaching sentient beings with judgment. Okay? Do you approach sentient beings with judgment sometimes? Yeah? We sit around, we look around the room, and it's like, you know, this one's too fat, this one's too thin, this one, you know, why do they part their hair on the right? They should part it on the left. That one has blue hair, that one has pink hair. This is in the US. Just wait a year, it'll catch on here. That person walks in a straight line and they're stiff. Another person is looking side to side. Why do they do that? Somebody walks with their head down. Somebody walks like this. And, you know, we have a running commentary on everybody. Kind of like a sportscaster, except it's all our opinions. Oh, that one looks rich. Maybe I want to talk to him. That one doesn't look rich. I'll forget him, you know? That one's young and attractive. Oh, yeah, very good. Oh, that one's old, gray hair, wrinkles. Forget it. You know, and we're full of opinions. And we think we know people, you know, by the color of their skin, yeah, by their height, by their physical dexterity. We form all sorts of opinions about people. And we've never talked to them. We don't know what's in their heart, you know. And we just make these snap decisions about who we like and who we don't like. Yeah. Do you think that's fair? Do you think that's wise? Yeah. So something's wrong with our current way of approaching people with all these opinions. So we have to stop the judgment. One way to stop the judgment is whenever we catch ourselves doing it, because we're just focusing on tiny details, to move our mind back to, this is a sentient being who wants happiness and doesn't want suffering just like me. Okay? So I'm going to be friendly to them in the same way that I would like them to be friendly to me. Okay. So that should be we want to make that our usual way of approaching sentient beings. Then compassion comes next, because if we see somebody suffering, those people that we approach with kindness and friendliness, if we then see them suffering, we want to respond with compassion, not fear, not disgust. Okay? And I say this because sometimes when we see beings who are suffering, it's scary for us. We don't like to go in the hospital and visit sick relatives. Why? Because it reminds us that we are also prone to illness and death. And that's scary. So we don't want to see people who are sick. Yeah. We don't want to see people who have problems. Yeah. Some people, you know, if somebody is sobbing out of grief, some people completely walk away. They can't handle it. Yeah. Sometimes if we see somebody in pain, or we see somebody who's angry and upset, we react with fear. What we want to do is cultivate a mind that instead reacts with compassion. Compassion being the mind that wishes them to be free of their suffering and the cause of their suffering. Because if you're sick, wouldn't you want people to react to you that way? If you were poor, wouldn't you want people to react with compassion to you instead of with fear? Okay? So again, it's training our minds not to make snap judgments about people just based on what we first see. I remember being in Bodh Gaya one time at His Holiness Dalai Lama's teachings. And of course, he always talks about compassion and how important it is. And at the end of the teaching, I was walking back to where I was staying. And I saw one beggar who was collapsed on the ground, you know, not just sitting and begging, but he had collapsed. And so I went to help him. And some people around me said, no, no, don't go touch him. He's a beggar. Don't go. And, you know, it's like you just get done listening to His Holiness talk about compassion. You can't not go. Yeah? It's like, because His Holiness' voice is still in your head. And, you know, and so I went and was together with a couple of other people. We stood him up. We got him some water. Then we, you know, helped him sit down and, you know, made sure he was okay. But it was amazing how some people said, no, don't even touch him. But he's another sentient being, just like the rest of us. Okay? So, love and friendliness as our usual way of approaching. But then when we see those same people suffering, we have compassion. When we see them happy and succeeding in what they want to do, we rejoice with them. Yeah? We don't get jealous of them. We rejoice. Yeah? Sometimes when we see people successful, or we see people with good qualities, oh, we burn with jealousy. Yeah? Why can't I be athletic like that person? Why can't I look like this person? Why can't I be intelligent like that? You know? So comparing ourselves to others, but always putting ourselves down. I'm not good enough. They're better than me. And then being jealous and resentful of them for being better than us. Okay? Jealousy is a very painful mind, isn't it? Yeah? I had one experience with jealousy. So jealous, and it was so painful that I said, I have to practice the Dharma to get rid of this because I cannot stand the mental pain of jealousy. You know, it just burns you up inside. So, you know, instead of jealousy, we rejoice. We respond with joy. How wonderful that they're successful. How wonderful that they have these good qualities. And really, if you think about it, isn't it good that other people have better qualities than us? You know, because everybody has the qualities that they excel in and the qualities that they don't. And we need everybody's qualities and talents and skills so that society functions. If I were the best of everybody, yeah, we would not be sitting in a building because I have no idea how to construct a building. We would not have electricity because I don't understand how electricity works. We would not have running water and plumbing because I don't know how to do that either. Okay, so if I were the best in the world, we would be in really dire straits. Yeah? We'd all be sitting out in the dirt, in the heat, nothing to eat because I don't know how to grow anything either. And okay, I can lead you in a meditation while you're starving and hot and uncomfortable. But that's, you know, kind of, you need your basic needs taken care of first. So it's good. I'm really glad there are people who are architects and construction workers and plumbers and electricians and engineers and so forth, because I can't do any of that. So we each contribute to society in a different way. We need everybody's skills. So that's why it's so useless and ridiculous to compare ourselves to other people, because we need everybody. Okay? It's not a question of I've got to be best. Yeah. It's I have some talent and I want to contribute. Okay? So instead of arrogance, instead of jealousy, we contribute and we help others. Okay? So we rejoice at their success. Then the fourth one, there is equanimity at the end. And there the idea is, if we're trying to help sentient beings who have problems, but they aren't very receptive to the help that we're giving, yeah, we usually feel very frustrated, don't we? Yeah. We have a cousin who has a substance abuse problem. We try and point that out to them and get them to stop. They tell us to go away. Yeah. We have children who don't study as much as we would like them. Not that we studied as much as our parents wanted us to do, but forget that. You know, look at your own children. They should study more. Yeah. And then we get frustrated because they don't. And, you know, hey, they're kids. Yeah, why do we expect kids to sit at a desk and concentrate on some stuff that is not so interesting all day long at school, and then come home and have tuition afterwards? Yeah? Singapore is the only country I go to where there are parks and I hardly ever see children playing in the parks. Yeah? I travel a lot. Every other country, there are kids playing outdoors because, first of all, they need exercise. Second of all, playing together gives them social skills. Third, playing increases their creativity because they dream up games and so on. Playing is something, is part of being a healthy human being, and it's part of a child's education. Why do we think the only way kids should be educated is with a book and a piece of paper and a pen? And why do we want to test them and stream them when they're this big? You know? I'll give you an example from my family. My little brother, yeah, when he was in primary two, he had the thing that many children have called dyslexia, where your D's and your B's are reversed, you know, and he saw things backwards. And he had that problem. He was very slow in learning, okay? If he had been in Singapore, they would have streamed him into, who knows, you know, like the lowest stream. But my brother, you know, as he grew up, he matured. And today he's a doctor. He's a radiological oncologist. You know? So he has some smarts. Yeah. But if he had been streamed as a kid, he never would have had the opportunity to develop his abilities and his intelligence. Yeah? So I think, you know, we need to really think, what does educating children mean? Does it just mean cramming them full of boring facts? Or does it mean to teach them how to be good citizens in a country? How to be honest? How to communicate well with others? How to get along well with others? How to be responsible human beings? Isn't that part of an education of a child? Why don't we teach that in schools? Okay? So I used to be a teacher before I became a nun. So somehow it's coming up again, and I gotta talk about it. Yeah? And I think our education system should be creative. It should be interesting. Yeah? I mean, I remember learning how to read with some things that were like so boring, you know? And what we should do is see what kids are interested in and then give them material on that topic, and they will learn to read because they're interested in that. Not because we're cramming down, you know, how to sound out words and all of that stuff. Yeah, you remember going through all of that? Okay, so let me get off my soapbox. Back to the task at hand. Yeah. But the idea is, I get off on that. When beings are not doing very well, we try and help them, but they aren't open to our help. We get angry and we feel frustrated. Okay? So instead of that, we train our mind to feel equanimity. Yeah? Which is, equanimity is just a balanced mind. I'm not angry, I'm not attached, I just accept the situation. Okay. By the way, those of you, well, no, actually this applies to all of us. We really need to check when we want to give somebody advice or help them with the problem, if we're the right person to do that. Okay? When you have teenage children, as a parent, depending on your relationship with your child, you may not be the right person to give them guidance. Okay? So that's why it's helpful when the kids are young, have them develop relationships with other adults so that then when they become teenagers, these other adults can give them advice, because sometimes they don't want advice from their parents. Okay? This also goes for all of our other relationships. Sometimes you want to give advice to your parents when they're elderly. Yeah, I know when we wanted our dad to stop driving, you know, we tried to talk to him as three kids. All three of us talked to him. He did not want to stop driving. Okay. We weren't the right people to say that to him. Yeah. I'm sure if one of his friends who had stopped driving said to my dad, you know, it's time to stop driving. Let the other people drive you around. My dad could have accepted that, but not from his kids. Yeah? So we have to really look at whether we're the right person to give the advice. And if we aren't, then try and get somebody in who could give the advice. And better yet is to have people have multiple relationships so that they may naturally go to somebody else when they need advice about a problem. Okay, and that works much better than us forcing our advice on somebody when they don't want it. Okay, and then we're angry and then they get mad at us. And then, you know, instead of solving a problem, we create another problem. Because then they don't want to talk to us. And we don't want to talk to them either, because I'm trying to help you and you aren't listening to the help. I'm doing so much for you and you don't listen to me. Does that, if somebody talked to you that way, would you listen to that person? No, you'd tune them right out, wouldn't you? Even they're giving good advice, if they say it like that, pooh, you tune them out. Okay? So be careful how you talk to other people. Because you may have very good things to say, but they're not going to listen if you talk like that. Okay, so that's one way to look at the Four Immeasurables. There's another way, and this is a way of still going in the same order, starting with love. This is the way they say with children, when you have children. So your baby's born, you automatically love that child. Okay? So love comes first. Then the second one, compassion, when your child gets sick, when they have difficulties, you have compassion. Comes quite easily. Yeah, you're willing to stay up all night with them if they're sick. You know, you do whatever needs to be done to take care of your child because your compassion is right there. Then as the child grows older, they develop their own interests. They become good at different things and you rejoice. Now here's another tip for parents. How many of you are parents? Yeah? Okay. What your kids are good at may not be what you want them to be good at. What your kids want to do as an occupation may not be what you want them to do. Who you want your child to be marry may not be the person that they want to marry. Okay? So, as a parent, what you need to practice when this happens is you need to practice equanimity. You rejoice at the things that they're good at, even though they may not be what you want them to be. You want your kid to be an engineer. Yeah? They want to study literature or art. You want your kid to be an artist. They want to do computers. Or they want to work on a boat. Yeah? You gotta relax as a parent, you know. Each child is gonna find happiness in their own way. Your job as a parent is to give them skills to deal with life, not to make them as the duplicate of yourself or to make your kids be what you aspired to be but never became. Yeah. That's even worse, isn't it? You know, you had certain dreams, you weren't able to fulfill them. My kid is going to be a basketball star. Yeah. I don't care if he's only this big. He's going to be a basketball star because I wanted to be a basketball star and I wasn't able to, you know. This happened to my nephew, you know, his dad pushed him to do football, yeah? And he did football for a while, and then, you know, he wasn't big enough to continue doing football. Yeah, his dad wasn't so happy. The rest of us were so glad he quit football, because it's a dangerous sport. Yeah. So, you know, as a parent, you have to learn how to be flexible, you know? Rejoice at your child's successes and have equanimity when they grow up and they make their own decisions. You know? And your kid will make mistakes. And that's how they learn. Did you, let me ask, did any of you do exactly what your parents wanted you to do all the time? Yeah? Did you do things that your parents told you not to do? Did you not tell your parents everything you did? Okay. So your kids are going to be the same. Did you learn things from doing stuff that your parents told you not to do? Did you learn from doing that? Yeah. Did you sometimes make mistakes, even maybe doing things that your parents wanted you to do, but you made a mistake? And did you learn from your mistakes? Yeah? So that's a lot how children have to learn. Yeah. We all have to learn that way. I look back at some of the biggest mistakes I made, and right now I really appreciate them. Because if I hadn't made those mistakes, I would not have grown up in certain ways, and I would not have been able to do what I'm doing now. Yeah? So I really have to say, to be appreciative of my mistakes. And I have to be appreciative of the people who hurt me, because they taught me a whole lot. Yeah? So I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I could get into all sorts of stories about that, but you have to ask me. No, I'm joking. Okay. So that's another way to think about the four immeasurables as a parent does towards a child. Okay. Then the way that we have them here, we start out with equanimity. Okay. So this is when we go to meditate to develop bodhicitta, yeah, the aspiration for full awakening to benefit all beings, we start out with first generating equanimity, because the kind of love and compassion that we want to develop in order to become a bodhisattva has to spread equally to all living beings. Yeah, because it's easy to love friends and relatives. Yeah, that doesn't require much work. And we very naturally have antipathy towards the people who hurt us. My teacher pointed out that so does a dog. When their owners come, dogs wagging their tail, they're so happy to see their owners. When a stranger comes, the dog barks. If somebody tries to harm their owner, they bite the dog. They bite the person. Okay. So my teacher said, you know, helping our friends, harming our enemies, this is exactly what animals do. Yeah. And we have human intelligence. We want to use our human intelligence to do things that animals can't. So in order to do that, yeah, we have to get rid of our bias, our partiality. Yeah. So that's why we meditate on equanimity first, yeah, to free ourselves from attachment and antipathy towards others. Then we can approach everybody with equanimity. Yeah. And that way, that acts as a basis for us then to consider others' kindness and to see them as lovable, as endearing. If we don't have equanimity, yeah, everything is going to be colored by our bias and partiality, and we won't be able to develop love and compassion that are for every living being. Okay. So that's why equanimity comes first. Then love comes, and when we're developing bodhicitta, there's a certain kind of love that comes, and that's the endearing love. When we train our mind to see other living beings as endearing. Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? When you look at everybody, instead of having your judgmental opinion factory going all the time, to be able to look and see them as endearing. Yeah. People who you normally would have ignored, you look at now and you think as endearing. I try and practice this, you know, especially with elderly people, because, you know, my parents are both gone now, but I think these elderly people, they're the parents of other people, most of them are, yeah. And they love their kids the way my parents love me. Hopefully their kids love them, I don't know. But I want to extend some kindness to them and to look at them with kindness. Yeah? Because, you know, they've had kids, they've worked in society, you know, spent how many years working at a career, and how much I have benefited from the work they did for society. Okay? And so to really treat the elderly with the respect that they deserve. Because they have a lot of experience. And if you talk to them, they have really interesting stories to tell you. Mm-hmm. I always try to get my grandma to tell me stories. But she was an immigrant to the U.S. She was a refugee. She didn't want to talk about her stories. She said it was too painful. Yeah, but whenever I can get other older people to talk about their experiences in life, I find it incredibly interesting. Yeah, because they've had experiences that I've only read about in the history book. Now, you notice how I'm talking, that I have no realization at all that other people think I'm one of those elder people. Yeah, I still think of myself as somebody young. So other people probably look at me and say, oh, there's that old lady with gray hair. She probably has some interesting stories because she's lived through things I read about in the history books when the dinosaurs were alive. So, anyway, erroneous self-identity. Anyway, so there, you know, equanimity for everybody. Then seeing living beings as heartwarming, then developing compassion for them. And also, then we can develop just the regular love that wants them to have happiness and its causes. And then after that, developing the joy that wants them to attain liberation and awakening and abide in that peace forever. Okay, we got through 6 paragraphs. Okay, so we have time for a little bit of Q&A. Questions? Yeah.
This is a medicine Buddha practice. There are many people always think that, oh, I'm very sick now, so I come for medicine Buddha practice and it will help me. But I think it goes more than that. Can you please elaborate that, please?
Yeah, very good question. Yeah, sometimes, you know, we're sick. Okay, gotta practice medicine Buddha. gotta practice white Tara, her speciality is long life. Then we feel better, drop those practices. Okay? Oh, I have to take exams, practice Manjushri. Yeah? After my exams, forget Manjushri. Huh? Facing some obstacles, practice Tara. The obstacles go away, forget Tara. Okay, this is not the way to do it. Okay? The Buddhas, you know, and these meditations are, they are our guides from here to awakening. Okay? So we shouldn't just practice something when we have a crisis. We need to develop the understanding of these practices over time. Because if you look at the Medicine Buddha practice, yeah, it contains the meditation on renunciation, the disadvantages of samsara, because you have to meditate on that to generate bodhicitta. So then it contains the meditations on bodhicitta. It contains the meditations on emptiness when Medicine Buddha dissolves into you. It contains many, concentration meditation when you train your mind single-pointedly on one object being the Medicine Buddha. So this is a practice that can lead us to awakening. It needs to be supplemented by other practices. We have to learn these stages of the path or the long rim. We have to learn the thought training practices. We have to learn some of the philosophical teachings, yeah. But all of that is we learn, and we can incorporate in this practice too. Yeah. So it's really something to do with that motivation of to attain full awakening, not just when you're sick. Over here.
What's the difference between equanimity and that you don't care?
Don't
care about.
Don't
care. Oh, okay. Very good question, too. The difference between equanimity and apathy. Apathy, I don't care. Yeah? Like Melania Trump's jacket. Did you hear about Melania Trump's jacket? She was flying off to the border of Mexico with the U.S., where a lot of immigrant children were imprisoned in cages. And she got on the plane wearing a jacket. On the back of the jacket it says, "I really don't care, do you?" People speculated what she really meant. There were a lot of speculations about what she meant. But I must say that wasn't the best choice of clothes when you're going to see children being kept in cages. Even if we weren't referring to that. Anyway, back to your question. Sorry. Okay, the difference between equanimity and apathy. Apathy, we just don't care. You know, we don't care. They're happy, they're unhappy, I don't care. Yeah, they don't relate to me, I don't know them. You know, why should I go out of my way for them? They haven't done anything for me. Okay, so I don't care. You know, I'm busy with my stuff. Okay. That's clearly not a virtuous attitude. Okay. Equanimity is just a mind that is free of attachment and anger and bias. Yeah? So we're free from partiality, we're free from apathy, we're free from anger. So our mind is open. Yeah? The open mind of equanimity allows us then to take the next step and generate affection for others that wants to reach out and benefit them. Okay? So So there's a big difference between equanimity and apathy. Yeah. With apathy, we are shut down. With equanimity, we are open. Okay. So, yeah?
And so, I know that we can't actually change a person, and this practice is small on here, our own mind. But, for example, if our parents are sick, you know, how can we actually utilize the practice of the medicine Buddha to help them? Mm.
Then, what I said at the beginning, you imagine all the sentient beings around you. Your parents are included in all sentient beings. So you think about them specifically. Or if you have a friend who is ill, or whoever you know who's ill, you know, you can imagine them there. And they don't have to be ill for you to practice medicine Buddha to help them. You know, is that like, you know, I'd really like to help you, so get sick. Yeah. No. It's, yeah. Because this practice, like, you know, she brought out, it isn't just for illness. It's for really helping people to purify and develop their own qualities. And so we imagine, you know, them around us. And with the medicine Buddha on their head. So then when we say the mantra, the light comes into them, the white light and then the golden light. And then at the end, when the medicine Buddha dissolves into light and dissolves into us, the medicine Buddhas on their heads also dissolve into them. Now you're going to say, but wait a minute, I thought there was only one medicine Buddha. And now there's many medicine Buddhas. You know, what happened? Well, why can't there be many medicine Buddhas? Medicine Buddhas are not sentient beings like us. They can emanate many, many bodies. Okay? And they reach out. They do that automatically to benefit sentient beings. So don't get confused. You're saying, oh, there's only got to be one. He's on my head. Now does he have to go over to their head? But once he sinks into their heart, can he come out again? No, don't get confused, okay? Many medicine Buddhas.